Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next, producer's picks of the week. Highlights of the best What's Next episodes heard during a select week. On today's show, we'll hear two segments from episodes that aired this past week, starting with...
Our community's attitude has always been our strength is in community, and it's in bringing people together, and we'll continue to do that.
Monday's episode with Hamadi Ali and Kristen Heltman Weiss of Providence Farm Collective. And we'll close with...
I have a really good friend of mine. He's really deep into Black history, and he says Black history saved my life. And I love that.
Sure.
I absolutely love that because it absolutely changed my life too once I came into the enlightenment of understanding the whole perspective.
Emmanuel Kulu, an African historian and author. I'm Michael Loss. Thank you for tuning in. First, we revisit a conversation with Hamadi Ali and Kristen Heltman Weiss of Providence Farm Collective. Recently, the organization received unexpected news from the U.S. Department of Agriculture that a grant contract has been terminated just as growing season begins. The two sit down with Jay Moran to discuss the impact of this development, not only on the organization, but on the communities they serve.
You arrived today with what I consider a troubling document, and I will read just this. This is to the Providence Farm Collective. This letter provides notice that the United States Department of Agriculture is terminating your federal award. All right. Why is this happening? How do you understand this letter? I could read the whole thing, I guess, but I'd rather get into maybe some conversation about it.
Yeah. So how I understand this letter is that our incubator farm program, which is funded through the USDA's Beginning Farmers and Ranchers Development Grant Program, that it is considered by the government now to be a DEI initiative. And to us, the receipt of this was not only shocking and alarming, but heartbreaking. That fact couldn't be further from the truth. And that when I think of how PFC was founded as a grassroots initiative by the Somali Bantu community to bring in other community members to develop them as new entry farmers in our region. We were really careful in exploring across the country the kinds of programs we would develop and offer, and also the need in Western New York. And the fact is, you know, in Western New York, a third of all the refugees that resettle in our state are in this community. They all come with agricultural knowledge, experience, and honestly, a desire to grow their traditional foods, to be farmers. And this program was developed with the idea of building entrepreneurs in agriculture. And we've done it actually very successfully. So the fact that we received the second round of funding through this program to us said what we were doing was good, was right. And now, you know, we received this letter, which it terminates funding, significant funding for that program, and actually hurts all of us in Western New York.
And just to give, of course, the background, like you said, it started off as the Somali Bantu farm initially. So obviously, you know, the people that were involved, people were refugees for the most part from Somalia, from places in Africa. And of course, a lot of the folks who do farm out there right now are people who come from different places across the globe as well. At the same time, anybody can apply to be a farmer at the Providence Farm Collective, correct?
Correct. So as you mentioned, the Somali Bantus started this farm, and right after the Somali Bantus, I am part of the Somali Bantu community. When we arrived, our first concern is how do we keep and continue our heritage? How do we grow our own food? We come from agricultural background. How do we do this?
Did you farm? Did your family farm in Somalia?
Yes, my family farm, and there is a long story I always tell. I can go
love to
the
hear it. You're a good place for it.
Yeah, so right after we fled Somalia with my parents, we relocated to Kenya as refugees, and the United Nations High Commission for Refugees was giving food to refugees, but a lot of the Somali Bantus forgone the rations and chose to farm to grow their own food.
Okay.
Because they didn't want to rely on handouts. And to me, this was like, you're getting free food. Why try to grow your own food? But the idea was self-sufficiency. And I spent 12 years in refugee camps, both in Kenya and Tanzania. And when we came to the States, my family was resettled right on West Ferry. If you're familiar with Buffalo, the La Nova Pizzeria, right across the street.
Sure, yes. Sure, near Hampshire and all
and
those, yeah.
The next morning that we arrived, my parents, well, the night we came at night, and both my mom and dad and the caseworker who brought us to the house introduced us, kind of give us orientation.
Sure.
Yes. And there was a plenty of food. There was cereal, pasta, rice, beans. And after she left, we went to bed. Waking up in the morning, I hear my parents in the kitchen talking that there wasn't food in the house. And this was a shocker to me. There was food last night. Actually, somebody came in the house and robbed us.
Oh, my.
So I walk into the kitchen, and my parents were like, oh, no, this is not food. I was like, it is food. So I always tell that story. And that is what sparked me. And my father actually was very serious about it. He said, no, I want to see real food. And if there is no real food, I humbly ask them to take me back where they took me from, because I want real food. So I asked him, Dad, what is real food? He's like, I need to have like collard greens, amaranth, okra, green bananas, corn, fresh corn. Like, oh, okay. So I took that to heart. Like, okay, this man is ready to go back
to a refugee camp.
Camp where it is not a good place to be.
Right.
Unless you're forced to be there. This must be very serious. So I looked around, and the only thing I could see was the backyard.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, our landlord from Sicily, when he came, I've explained it to him, and he knew, and he said, that's the experience. I had the same experience when I came to this country. So you know what? Feel free to grow whatever you can grow, but you have to call this number to check if there's anything underneath before you dig, just to make sure.
Okay.
Other than that, grow whatever you want to grow.
So this is basically where the Providence Farm Collective started.
And that's where the Somali Bantu
the backyard on West Ferry Street.
Yes, the Somali Bantu. So the community started seeing that coming, seeing Lord tomatoes growing, and everyone was like, "Well, we need this. How can we make this big?" And we started the Somali Bantu community organization.
Sure.
And when the organization started, our main goal was to find farmland. And farmland access is no joke.
No.
It's not.
And just to jump in here, though, now you're out on Burton Road.
Yes, we are.
In Orchard Park. How many acres?
37.
37 acres of farmland, and it's all farmed.
Yes. Right? Yeah. We're out of tillable land.
You're out of tillable land and actually leasing some land as well.
Yes.
All started basically from the drive to want to have socially, I guess I'll call it, or culturally acceptable food.
Food, yes.
Right. And so now there is several different communities, we can talk about who they are, producing all of this food out in Orchard Park.
Yeah. Yeah, yearly it's 100,000+ pounds of produce.
100,000+ pounds.
Feeding over 14,000 Western New Yorkers a year.
Wow.
Yeah, and we, you know, through you know, this has been a lifelong commitment of Hammadi's and the Somali Bantu community to like see fresh food needs, not just within their community or even other refugee communities. Hammadi has partnerships with Bread of Life Outreach in Colden. We donate, our farmers donate across Western New York because everybody eats. Everybody deserves access to fresh food.
And just getting back now to this letter from the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Yes.
This idea that, and again, we're somewhat paraphrasing, and I'm going to put my own paraphrasing in, and I apologize if I'm slightly erroneous in this concept, but the idea is the falling under this notion that we've heard from this new administration that they're, you know, going to reverse DEI or basically outlaw any kind of DEI initiatives and federal funded programs. The idea being, again, I'm going to try to paraphrase this concept that DEI is somehow discriminatory.
Yes.
Does, well, the basic question, does Providence Farm Collective discriminate?
No. We are a community of Western New Yorkers, and you will come to the farm any given day and find, you know, 80 and 90-year-old American-born women working alongside folks in our giving garden. You will find people from across Western New York who are in community together to support this really important work for all of us. It's food access. It's educating, you know, agricultural entrepreneurs and empowering them. But it's also this idea of transitioning and protecting our farmland in the region,
right? because let's be honest, in Orchard Park, in that particular location, if that's not being farmed, if you're not there, it's a housing development.
Exactly. And there's huge pressure for that. And that's actually happened across Erie County. We've lost 40% of our farmland to development. And when you think about the importance, the security importance of a region to be self-sufficient and its ability to feed its community, this directly threatens that.
And to take it back to your story to a certain extent, Hammadi, and the stories that you can share about some of your fellow farmers who are out at the Providence Farm Collective, this is an opportunity for these families not only to get culturally appropriate food, but also just food in general, right? I mean, it's a self-sufficiency, right?
Yes, it is. It's a self-sufficiency both to the farmers and the whole region.
Right.
As Kristen indicated earlier, we have partnered with various food pantries across the city where we take fresh food. We started the farmers market on the west side. Again, back to my story, when we first arrived, there was no grocery store nearby. We used to push grocery carts from Amherst Street to West Ferry to just buy produce. Right now, during the summer, you have the farmer's market there on Grand Street bringing fresh, affordable produce.
Discussions on this program before, and I think it's become hopefully for most people that, you know, the Buffalo's West Side has been rejuvenated. It's by refugees and immigrants coming to this area. I think it's indisputable, but I'll just leave it at that. And so to that though, I mean, there's always this kind of idea that, well, how can the United States, how can a city bring in more people? There's not enough. But here's a situation. Mm-hmm. Where people are finding not only a safe home, because they've lived in refugee camps probably for several years before they come to the United States and come to Buffalo, they're finding ways. The people aren't a burden to the society. They're a huge benefit to our local economy, our local culture.
Exactly. For example, the farmers, every penny, every dollar that they earn through their farm business goes right back to the economy. A lot of the farm, well, all of the farmers work minimum wage jobs. Mm-hmm. And the farm income, it kind of supplements their income. It's an extra income to them. They get more disposable income, which they take back right back to a Western New York economy. So the farmers are not a burden. They right. will come here and they want all the available opportunities. But coming from a farming background here in the States, trying to go on your own to access land, it's almost undoable.
Right.
If you can read or write. We have a lot of folks who came here and have given up. But now you have farmers. We have one farmer right now who's this year actually starting his own urban farm in the East Side.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yes, he is starting. How did that happen? Because of Providence Farm Collective. On his own, he tells me every day, yesterday, he's like, I couldn't have done this. But now I'm able to farm. I'm able to pass down my legacy. This person has been farming all his life in the Congo, came to Buffalo, and until he came to PFC, it's like, I almost given up.
Wow.
But once I found PFC, everything is flourishing right now.
And so now he's going to be a producer himself on the East Side and probably land that was maybe left behind, right?
It was actually a urban farm. So he, you know, there's where he's fortunate. There's okay. some infrastructure.
So yeah. All right.
But still, and that actually, you bringing that up goes to an interesting point in that actually growing on land that's left behind, even on the East Side, is really difficult to do.
Of course.
Because I think of Allison Dehoney, Buffalo Go Green, for years tried to purchase vacant lots and wasn't able to do that. So I think like this question of accessing land is a huge one in our region. And we also work with young farmers of the Good Farmers Guild. They're new entry farmers who are American born, and they also are trying to work through this issue of how do you support new entry farmers in accessing farmland and capital across our nation. Those two things are the biggest threat to transitioning farmland to a new generation of farmers. And so we're not unique in that way, but we are, I think, ahead of the curve in Western New York because we have these incredible partnerships. The Western New York Land Conservancy is one of our partners. We are all trying to work to solve this problem for Western New York.
We're with Hamadi Ali and also Kristen Heltman Weiss from the Providence Farm Collective this morning. If you're just joining us, Kristen and Hamadi walked in this morning with a letter from the USDA telling them that their Department of Agricultural grant, federal grant, has been canceled, terminated because of, to put it short, because it's being considered a DEI initiative. Just to kind of review that. Hamadi?
Yes.
We talked about this beforehand and you were able to do it. How many different communities are being represented out at Providence Farm Collective?
We have 9 different communities that farm at Providence Farm Collective.
Okay.
And from
you can still do it off the top of your head? Can you tell me who they are?
Definitely.
Okay.
So we have the Somali Bantu community. We have Ethiopian community. We have Burundi community. We have the Congolese community. We have the Bengali community. We have the Karenni community, Vietnamese community, and the Liberian community.
Burundi.
Burundi community.
Yeah. Yeah. I know I'm trying to keep them all straight too, so. Hamadi.
I'm wondering for you, what are you learning as you get more? I mean, you've been doing this now for a while, but what are you learning from these different cultures? I'm curious.
And it is funny you asked that question. A very good example, if someone sees me down the street with a Burundi or a Congolese, they will assume these people are very similar. Maybe they come from the same country.
Sure.
But we are not. And I don't say that in a bad way.
Right.
But those people actually were right in a way. I came to find out our languages are so close.
Is that right?
Okay. Yes. Some words are very similar. How did I came to find this out? We have a lunch table where all the farmers congregate and we eat together and we get to share ideas. And sometimes we speak in our native languages and we get to learn. And that table, it's called Meza ya Simulizi, the table of stories. You get to share your stories, whatever that is, you share with folks. And it's a beautiful thing. You have someone from Bangladesh who we might not have commonalities, but when we sit down and talk, there's that human connection. There's,
right.
Yeah. The other day I learned, I was talking to a coworker, a colleague, and she likes whistling.
Okay.
And I was like, why do you love whistling? She's like, well, it's a habit. But you know what? In my culture, it's frowned upon because it's like calling snakes. I'm like, well, it's the same in my culture, but it's like calling the devils. Oh. It's like, oh, we all share the same things. And that's what Providence Farm Collective does. Apart from farming, it's just people connecting cultures and learning from one another.
How about for you? I mean, Kristen, and obviously you take you come from a different perspective, but what about for you? What do you see? You know, when you see all these different cultures, these individuals from different cultures out working this farmland.
Oh, I see how much we have in common, honestly. So Hamadi and I have been working in partnership for 9 years now. We've been friends a little bit longer than that. And to me, it's always been this idea of how much we do have in common. You know, I think you ask anybody what's most important to them, and on any day, it's their family, right? It's caring for their family. We've grown this community that, you know, not to be like saccharine, but we are like this large Western New York family where we attract people from across the region who really are committed to being a part of this community of care. And that resonates with me. My kids come to the farm. My husband is very much involved from the beginning with all of this. My sister, my nieces. This is something where families congregate, where people from across Western New York who happen to also be from across the world
right.
sit down and share a meal 5 days a week with one another. You know, Jay, if you're a guest at PFC, you're welcome at our lunch table.
You won't walk away hungry.
And, you know, you won't walk away hungry, but also you'll walk away actually feeling really good about the community we live in. And I think, you know, so yeah, we received this letter, but we're going to keep continuing to do what we do, and that is to build community connection in Western New York, to share our love of farming, our love of food, our love for one another with the greater community.
Love for farming. You love farming?
Oh, yes.
I know it's part of your heritage, but you love it.
A part of my heritage. I've almost, started the Somali Bantu Community Farm because of my parents, but eventually I came to love farming more than I did, you know, when I was back home or when I was in my teenagers.
Yeah, changed? What changed for you?
Apart from the food, just being in the field itself, it's a stress relief.
Mm.
You get to work with nature. You get to work with your hands. You experience different things. You see how food is grown. I get to take my kids to the farm. I work with all my 4 children in the field. And to me, that is way, way more rewarding than anything else in life.
His youngest son was actually born like in the early years of the Somali Bantu community farm, and has been playing every summer. Like, I've watched him grow up literally on the farm. And that's another wonderful thing, is we actually have three folks on staff who were teens working on their community farms at Providence Farm Collective, who went on to college, graduated, applied for jobs at PFC, and are now doing incredible work alongside of us. So that's been incredibly fulfilling too.
That was Hamadi Ali and Kristen Heltman Weiss, the markets manager and executive director at Providence Farm Collective. We'll close out today's show with a conversation on the importance of African history and the gaps seen in education on the topic. We welcome Emmanuel Kulu, an African historian and author. He sits down with Jay Moran to analyze the impact of media on perceptions of Black Americans, the necessity of teaching African history to prevent future racial incidents, and the need to reclaim African history.
You're an individual with some wide-ranging experience, but you have I don't say singular focus, but most certainly your interest in African history is noteworthy for sure. As a matter of fact, you're going to be taking part in an event coming up at the Buffalo History Museum. Mm-hmm. That's on May 15th. One Race, the Human Race is the title.
Yes.
Tell me what to expect.
Yeah, you know, I expect our community leaders, our health service workers, our social workers, our educators, all to come out and to show solidarity against white supremacy. This particular event will be an educational event. We're going to have Jillian Hainsworth, who really emerged during the time of 514 as the poet laureate in the city of Buffalo, the founding one. I got to give a big shout out to Jillian.
The first. Always will be the first.
Always will be the first. We're also going to have Gardnell Whitfield is going to do a brief speaking at the event as well. We hope to have the African American Cultural Center to support us with some African drumming. And I will be the keynote speaker, which is the main topic of the event, One Race, the Human Race, where we'll try to bring everyone into the scope of African history.
Let's get into that part of it. We've had some discussions on this program around that topic as well, but now it's your chance to bring your perspective. And I think that's the important thing, that, and I think you would agree that, you know, when the first and foremost, the absence of African history.
Yeah.
What have we lost because there has been that absence of African history in our classrooms?
Yeah, you know, you can't have world history without Black history. You can't have Black history without African history. This is all encompassing. I look at when you label a certain part of history, you don't hear, you know, Italian history, or you don't hear white history. You don't hear these terminologies placed on it. But when it comes to Black history, you see it's termed based on color. And I particularly don't agree with that perspective.
Okay.
Of it. I think it's more important to see it as a part of world history.
Right.
And particularly that geographical area and how it affected the whole entire world. African history, when you think about Africa, Africa is the only place in the world that doesn't need importation from any other part of the world to survive. And in fact, every thriving nation on the face of the earth needs Africa for survival. I was just looking at my cell phone and I was thinking about the coltan, the cobalt that comes out of the Congo. I was thinking about the rubber, the ivory, the diamonds, the gold that we wear on our rings for and buy for our wives. All of these things, they come out of Africa. You go into Congo, or you go into Ghana, or you go into even parts of Cameroon where cocoa is so rich.
Mm.
And then you think about those kids who work in those farms digging for cocoa and doing all this mining, and yet they've never tasted chocolate or ever had a cup of coffee. These are things that are not taught in our schools. So it's very, very important how Africa has been the center of survival for every thriving nation on the face of the earth. Why wouldn't it be included? So I think it's very important for us to include it, and not just from that perspective. We also can look at it from a scientific perspective. We can look at it from a biological perspective. Every human being, scientifically, comes out of East Africa.
Hmm.
So why wouldn't that be pivotal to our education? So this is why I saw that this was a need in our school systems. I was working with Dr. Fatima Morrell for many, many years, still continuing to work with Buffalo Public Schools. Shout out to Daphne Bell for continuing to bring me on even after Fatima departed.
Mm-hmm.
But I've been working with them for the last 7 years.
What's it like with the kids in Buffalo Public Schools? It's got to be an eye-opening experience.
They love it. We did African mask making. We did like a six-week course of African history where we're really covering 6,000 years
sure.
in 6 weeks. So it's amazing. They absolutely love it. And it's so interesting how many students had no clue that Africans had empires. And we know why that is, because the miseducation.
It's interesting to talk about your background as well.
Mm-hmm.
You grew up in the city here.
Yep.
McKinley High School grad, mm-hmm. ECC, UB.
Mm-hmm.
So a local kid all the way.
Yeah.
Your father, though, mm-hmm. was from Cameroon.
Yes.
Share with our audience the story you told me about you first going to Cameroon with your father. And
yeah.
I guess a little bit of a stunning surprise for you.
Yeah. You know, it was one of those things where, you know, you're told things right here. And that's why education is so important. You're told things right home that Africa's a jungle. Animals are just gonna attack you. You're gonna get sick if you eat the food. People are in poverty, flies flying around their head. But when you actually get there and you see the peace, the joy, and the connection that people have with the actual soil, it really changes your perspective. You go into the markets, you go into the city part of the region, and you're seeing all these things. It's no different from living here in America. Now, obviously you have your rural areas. Right. You have your areas that are still kept very natural. And then you have your city. It's just like if I were to drive out to East Aurora. Mm. Right. And I'm seeing more forest or tree area.
Yeah.
So to speak. So it's no different than that. And those areas where you're going to see the jungles or lions, most of those areas are gated off. You're not just going to be able to go over there unless you have some sort of license or you live in that tribal area, so to speak. So that's what people really don't understand. So that misconception, I even had it as a right. young man, and I got spankings for it. I got my behind toe up over speaking that ignorance because my father didn't play that. My father did not play that. He said, do not allow people to believe that your history began in slavery. So I started off as a very young man educating. The problem I had was I wasn't able to prove it at that time.
Right.
You know, because every book that I can share about African history at that time that was available to me was about the jungle or what National Geographic had presented all these years. So just sharing some of my experiences when I had been there with my family in Cameroon and the things that we were taught, the stories that we were told from ancient history, even about the transatlantic slave trade, how that is somewhat of a misconception as well. For example, many people believe that the majority of African people sold other African people, which is not true. It was maybe a minority, a small group of Africans who were in power at the time, who were participating in capturing and enslaving people and selling them. And on the flip side of that, they also didn't know what's going to happen on the other side of the water when they got there.
Right.
They didn't know what was going to happen to them. So a lot of these things are historical facts that we haven't been taught. We've been taught a very Eurocentric, narrow view of African history. So I sought to prove these things, and that led me to what I'm doing today.
How about your dad, when you were talking about him, and him not accepting uh-huh. what you came to understand about Africa,
mm-hmm.
how did he view the United States and the reality of African-Americans?
Yeah, I like that question. It's a very good question. My father, when he first came here, he also went through the same experience where people would say to him, do you come from a bush? Did you come mm-hmm. here with no clothes on? Did you come here naked? And he also had to educate. But he, when he met my mother was affiliated with the Panther Movement.
Okay.
In Chicago.
All right.
But when she moved to Buffalo, she started to get with some of the activist movements, such as the CAO. She worked with L. Nathan Hare for a long while. He was the CEO of CAO for a very long time. L. Nathan Hare, who also has the Alfonso Green Center as well. So she was affiliated with some black activists. So when my father and my mom got together, it was a cultural exchange.
Right.
It was the African-American experience in America and the African experience put together.
Right.
And me and my brothers and sisters, we are the result of that experience. So he got to understand what blacks in America were going through. Of course, you hear about the struggle, right? But it's another thing when you experience it. And I think as he came here, he started to realize being an African is no different than being black once you're in America. Mm. It's the exact same thing. So I think that's very, very important for any African immigrant to understand that once you're here in America, you're black.
Right.
So he fully ingratiated himself in the experience of being on both sides of the diaspora.
And not a small thing, but your dad came from Cameroon to play, as you've corrected me, football.
He played real football
in Cameroon. And he came to the University of Buffalo to play as well. It's a great... It's always so wonderful to be able to hear backgrounds like that and how perspectives evolve. Is that something that you share with your when you have these students at the Buffalo Public Schools that, you know, this is who I was, you know, you know, this is how I didn't understand. Is that something you share?
Absolutely. You have to start with meet the kids where they are.
Okay.
Right? And if you show them you've done it, you've done the research and it's changed your life, of course they would want to do it. You know, I have a really good friend of mine who's really deep into black history, and he says, black history saved my life. And I love that.
Sure.
I absolutely love that because it absolutely changed my life, too, once I came into the enlightenment of understanding the whole perspective, right? You know, it's one thing to just see it as all black history. It's another thing when you start to see it as human history. That really changes your mind over.
We're with Emmanuel Kulu this morning on... What's next here on Buffalo Toronto Public Media NPR. Emmanuel will be at Buffalo History Museum on May 15th. He's part of a program called One Race, The Human Race. And we're going to learn on that particular night, HEAL, Human Equality and Access Leadership. HEAL. So what? Give us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, we see in this time that we're living in where the war has been on DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. And we've also seen that movement kind of get usurped, so to speak. And some companies are kind of using it as a cover-up to cover their behinds. And why I say that is they were all for it when the presidency was all for it.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the presidency changed, they were no longer for it.
Right.
So that's why I say a cover-up, people who are dedicated.
It was almost a marketing element.
Mm-hmm. But when we came up with HEAL is this nation does need to heal. This nation needs to accept what the past was. How this country even came to be was usurped from the Native Americans and the black indigenous people who were on this continent prior to Europeans coming here.
Right.
All of that history needs to be told. It's a true history. And Professor Kaba Kabane once told me, he said, every piece of the puzzle is important, right? You can't just tell history episodically. You have to tell it holistically, okay? You have to say, hey, the transatlantic slave trade happened, but that's not the beginning of black history. Africans were doing monumental things. The Wall of Benin, which we talked about.
Right.
The largest wall, four times the size of the Great Chinese Wall. And in fact, that wall was so large it can encircle the United States four times.
Mm.
See, this is history that people don't know. Just thinking about Africa and just saying jungle, bush, mud huts, disease, impoverished people. How did it get that way? We have to see the holistic perspective.
You've traveled frequently to the continent, mm-hmm. and at the same time, it sounds like your most, I guess, on the ground experiences in Cameroon with your father as well. Mm-hmm. At the same time, can you maybe take us through? I mean, obviously, there's so much here, and we could probably go on and on and on. But mm-hmm. I want maybe just I'm interested in kind of in your own personal development as you moved through Africa. How things started opening up for you? What caught your eye? What started changing? What types of history, parts of history really were things that started moving you to, and obviously it's what's become your life's journey.
Yeah, you know, it was always so shocking because we're always told that the transatlantic slave trade was the beginning of Black history.
Right.
Again, my father never allowed us to accept that. So as I did start to move through and go to these places virtually and physically, I started to really connect with the people and see what is their perspective of Blacks in America, what is their perspective of America, period. Mm. And also, what was I seeing and how was I able to make a connection with the common people? So that was a really life-changing for me because there is a unification amongst Black people throughout the world, where wherever where you go. Even if you go to India, where the darkest people who are called the untouchables, so to speak, they call them the untouchables, they still identify themselves as being Black people. So just touching bases and seeing how culturally different they are, Africa is the most diverse place in the face of the planet.
Hmm.
So there's not one particular phenotype of Africans. There's so many. There's the narrow-nosed African. There's the long-haired African. There's the kiki-haired African. There's the red-skinned African. There's the Khoisan people who look very much like the Asians.
Hmm.
Nelson Mandela resembled them.
Okay.
Who are the oldest known DNA on the face of the earth is the Khoisan people. In derogatorily called the pygmies. You have the tallest people in Africa, in Sudan. You have some of the shortest, which I just mentioned, people who they called the pygmies. The Bantu, the Swahili. I mean, you could just go on. All of these different garms, all of these different foods. What are the differences?
Right.
What are the similarities? Like what we have in Cameroon, we call fufu.
Fufu,
right?
Okay.
Fufu is like a mashed potato, right?
All right.
And but some people make it with cocoyam. Some people make it with farina. Some people make it with powdered yam. And Ethiopians make it slightly just a little bit different. But it's still the same thing.
Did you make it in your house?
Yes. I still make it to this day.
Yeah?
Still make it to this day.
How do you make it?
I make it with farina.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So
okay.
just to see that beautiful cultural exchange. As a matter of fact, in ancient Egypt, you can find, I believe the original name for chess was called sunet.
Okay.
Okay. And that was, you can see how that has translated thousands of years later. You can see the Eye of Horus on the back of the dollar bill. You can see the obelisk that you can see downtown anywhere in the United States,
right?
That's standing everywhere. That comes out of Africa. Also, ancient Egypt, when I wrote my book, I Black Pharaoh Rise to Power, was the focus. And it was the focus because ancient Egypt has always been separated from Black history. So that has been a very pivotal point of my studies, is ancient Egypt being a Black African civilization. Because every time you see a movie, Gods of Egypt, Ten Commandments, Cleopatra with Elizabeth Taylor. Love Elizabeth Taylor. But
she's
you're
about as white as it gets, right?
So just those things. So bringing that back into the scope of African history. If you go into the French and the British Museum, you'll see a section, ancient Egypt. And then you'll see another section, Africa. Why isn't ancient Egypt in the same section? So it's stuff like that you notice. And then as I studied, I realized that ancient Egypt was not just pivotal for Eurocentric scholars to claim, but also it was pivotal for biblical studies to claim.
Okay.
Because ancient Egypt is, which was known as Kemet, which means land of the blacks. That was so important to biblical studies because the Israelite connection to Egypt with Moses and all of these things and Abraham. So they had to try to, Eurocentric scholars wanted to separate Egypt from Africa because if they didn't do that, they would have to say that these people that they are enslaving are the same exact people who built the pyramids. So I always say the same people who built the pyramids built the White House.
Well stated. Emmanuel Kula with us on What's Next. You mentioned also, and again, I don't want to make a monolith because, like you said, there's a lot of diversity in Africa. So to say the opinions and views of one part of Africa are the same as others. But you mentioned how you got to understand a little bit about Africans' view of Black Americans and also of America as well. I'm really interested to hear what you can share about that.
Well, the perspective is based off the media, right? The media promotes a very violent hip-hop, street, pimps, prostitution of Black America to the world. All right, that is mostly what we see in our media, period, when we see turn on the television. So a very narrow view. All right. And on the American side, we just mentioned.
Of course, yeah.
The jungles. Right. So you can see how both sides of the diaspora are a little bit divided.
Yeah.
And how this really puts me in a funny situation because I'm on both sides of the diaspora.
Right.
So, but yes, that is the image of African Americans abroad. Not just Africa, but that's what's being pushed to them. In fact, when many Africans come to America, they are told by their immigration officers, you're not like those other Black Americans.
Oh, jeez.
They're not like you. You're this, you're that, they're this, you're not the same. Don't get caught up in any type of movements or anything, or you could be deported back to your country. So this has also led to the diaspora divide. You know, not knowing those things. So again, this is why when we do Ancient African Antiquities Research Institute of America, we don't just want to pull Africans. We want to pull Europeans. We want to pull Asians, to all of them to understand that we all come out of Africa. And that is our common home place, the motherland for all of us. Once we realize those things, I think that'll change a lot. From the racist perspective, I think once we see each other as a family, I think that really could change that perspective.
I'm interested about what you mentioned about hip-hop. Hip-hop, a great art form.
Yeah.
It just continues to be creative and express all sorts of things. But it almost sounds like whatever's funneling through has maybe almost having a reverse effect on impressions of Black Americans.
Oh yeah, well, hip hop started on the streets. It started as a form of expressing your situation.
Right.
And the same thing like the Yoruba people who express through story, and you can even see hip hop even now in the Afrobeat music. So hip hop has transcended itself, but it is a business.
Mm-hmm.
And the business is promoting more of a very negative view of African American lifestyle, all right? Which is more or less the minority, not the majority.
Right.
There's a whole different group of educated African American people who are doing wonderful things in the world. But again, this is not what's promoted, all right? So again, I believe hip hop has gotten far away from its true essence, which was graffiti, which was the DJs breaking, which was the message. You know, Bob Marley loved the message. Tupac Shakur, my favorite MC of all time.
Is that right? Okay.
It's all about the message,
yeah.
Right? These artists, they said something and they moved people and they also helped people get through the struggle. You know, African-American people, as I mentioned to you before, the only people on the face of the planet that have been separated from their ancestral home. That's really, really tough. But we have still carried a lot of those things, sacred things from Africa. The storytelling, you know, this is how oral history was passed down to people. People who when the African drum, the djembe drum, was banned in slavery times because it was a form that they saw it as a form of rebellion or bringing people together for some sort of takeover, hostile takeover. Music is that for African-American people. I'm hearing all about this movie Sinners. And that's coming to my mind. I haven't seen it yet. But
our executive producer, Charles Gilbert, has seen it, by the way.
Yeah. But yeah. I'm hearing about it. And from what I'm hearing, this is what we're talking about with hip-hop. These vampires come into this music scene and the blues, and they're saying they're attracted to the sound of it, and they say, hey, we want to control it. We have to control the masters of it. And they use that through money. They use that through media attention. They use that through many different ways. And eventually, those artists are sucked right in, so to speak, into the world of white supremacy and misleading the common people, and they don't even know it.
All right, winding down here with our conversation with Emmanuel Kulu. Emmanuel will be at the Buffalo History Museum for a program called One Race, the Human Race. It starts on May 15th at 5:30. Got a couple of things I want to get back to on that, but beforehand, you did intrigue me about your family. Mm-hmm. You said your mother is from Chicago,
yep.
And she was a Black Panther.
Well, she was affiliated
with
the Panthers.
All right, okay.
She was affiliated with the Fred Hampton set. Fred Hampton was murdered in Chicago, south side of Chicago, in his house while he was sleeping by the police department. And that's when she realized that perhaps that movement was getting a little bit too much for her.
Sure.
Because of the oppression that happened to it. So she decided
But she must have taken a lot of influence from that movement.
Absolutely. Absolutely. She was one of those Afro-wearing women who really wanted to show her Black pride. So she decided that the best way to affect people was through education.
Okay.
So kind of the same perspective that I have on why education is so important.
The apple didn't fall far from the tree, huh? Yeah.
Exactly. Right, okay. Exactly. So she earned a double master's in education administration. She earned a master's in history. She also earned a master in English. So
And she taught in the city district?
And she taught to the city district. In fact, May 17th, from the day she passed in 2017, has been considered by Mayor Brown at the time, Betty Kulu Day, because what she did in this city as an educator. She was assistant principal over at Stanley Mikowski for about 12 years over there. Before then, she was a teacher.
And since we're talking family, your stepmom, though.
Yes.
A very different background.
Yes. My stepmother, similar. It's a little similar.
Okay.
She worked with children as well.
All right.
She started, she was the executive directing, founding director of the Child Care Coalition, which is now known as the Child Resource Network. Peg Agnello Kulu, she is an Italian woman. And what I remember so much about her is taking in so many children to the small community center from diverse communities. Because daycare was such a need in the early 90s. And we didn't have a lot of facilities for those particular communities. And she began to open many of them through the Child Care Coalition. So my stepmother really was very, very passionate about, she thought at one point, and she told this to us, she says, my white privilege can't transfer to you guys, unfortunately, but I will use it to the best of my ability to protect you guys. And I will never forget that about her, because she's since passed on. But her path was also about the children, and the children were the future. She also taught us a great deal about hustling a little bit. Why I say that? Because at my dad's soccer game, she was the the person who would have the Huggies, the juices, the little beers for the guys afterwards, and we'd sell it. And the hot dogs and the hamburgers, the ribs, whatever it may be, we would have all of this stuff that we pack up in this van and sell it. So my stepmother really gave that to me. So I got all of these jewels from the Italian culture, from her, from the Black proud, from my mom. Spirituality from my mom and the cultural African history from my dad. So I just put all of those things together and just try to present them to the world as who I am today.
We both certainly appreciate you presenting them to us on this last hour here. And we are coming down to the few final minutes here. And, as much as we've talked already, and we have, of course, mentioned the event at the Buffalo History Museum. Again, it's at 5:30, May 15th, One Race, the Human Race. Jillian Hainsworth will be there. But we haven't talked about the fact that the origin of this event is to honor the lives lost on May 14th, 2022.
Yeah.
We'll be up on the third anniversary of this.
Mm-hmm.
As best you can, you know, describe where, how you view, not just what happened 3 years ago, but what you've seen since then.
Yeah. You know, I saw a lot of DEI programs and I saw some come and go. But at that moment, it was very special. It was obviously the pain and the torment that we dealt with as a community to be targeted that way. For people to target a community that was once a food desert. But what was beautiful that came out of that was to see people who are not from the east side of Buffalo come into the east side of Buffalo and walk Jefferson Avenue and show solidarity. These theories, white replacement theories, or things that ignited the Ku Klux Klan and all of these different things that happened, that have the destruction of Tulsa, Oklahoma, all of these different things that have happened historically to Black Americans. At that point, that time, I saw a lot of people who are outside the Black community come in and show solidarity. So that was a beautiful thing.
Sure.
We brought a lot of awareness. When we saw what happened with George Floyd on a global level, people were saying, well, maybe Black folks is not just saying this stuff is happening. Maybe it's actually happening, you know, because they're seeing it in real time now.
Right.
So that was just another event that people are seeing in real time, white supremacy at its worst. So I think that was a great moment for it. Since, again, many companies said they were for diversity. They were at that point. And now we see where they are. So I'm also paying close attention to those companies who are doing that. And it also helps us to understand that the Montgomery boycott back in the 60s was very, very important. I think one of the strongest powers that African-American people have is their spending power. And when you notice these companies don't support you or don't support diversity, don't support inclusion, these are the people we need to start spending our money with.
What about in the city? I mean, you're spending time in the classroom through your work as well.
Mm-hmm.
So you get to see, you know, some, unfortunately, here we don't get to see much of the youth. We get a few here and there for different programs. But what do you see in the classroom? Do you sense any connection to 514 when you're in the classroom? Is that something that is discussed or just?
I think it should be more discussed.
Right.
Yes, it has been discussed. I've been a part of events where it has been discussed.
Okay.
Some kids don't understand the depths of it. And when we're seeing what's happening now, the wiping out, the whitewashing, and the removing of Black history from our schools, it's really not going to prevent future events like that from happening. It's just going to make the chances even worse because we're saying it's, you know, it's not needed history, but it is. It's very much. How do we, you know, a great person, a historian, some say a historian is a future teller, but they say that because history just repeats itself, especially if you don't learn from it. So it's very, very important that we learn this history and we teach it to these children, because these children are going to be the ones that are going to either push it forward or push it away.
And that will do it for this edition of Producers Picks of the Week. We thank our guests, Hamadi Ali, Kristen Heltman Weiss, and Emmanuel Kulu. If you missed anything or just want to hear it again, you can get this program as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts, including the full individual episodes aired in today's compilation. Each episode is online at btpm.org. I'm Michael Loss. Thank you for listening. Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.